removed from the weak wave.
All right, so the heat wave that struck the Pacific Northwest last week would have been, quote, virtually impossible without climate change, concluded climate experts from around the world. The heat wave killed several hundred people and contributed to crop failures and wildfires. Experts believe that by the end of the century, the chance of such an event occurring somewhere in the world will rise to 20% in a given year.
Heat waves, they have me back up at my pulpit and on my soapbox about how terrible humans are. You know, outside of global warming, which I believe that for anybody out there who doesn't believe that the world is getting warmer, it is. And scientists know that it is because when they look at the molecule, they can tell if it was a man-made, you know, so it's not super volcanoes, the carbon. They can tell by the amount of little guys in there where that carbon comes from. But let's pretend that it's not man-made.
Sure.
We still got to live in it.
Yeah, no, we got to.
It's still hot. It totally sucks. And our world is burning down, and we need to somehow mitigate this disaster together. So I don't know. Can't we come together on that part? Can't we pull one part out of it and say, hey, let's work on it. And the other part can keep fighting.
Yeah. It's insane to me that there's no like discussion in the Pacific Northwest now of like, hey, maybe since this is going to be something that affects literally everyone, maybe should we have like funding to install AC in places?
Absolutely.
Like, you know, and I haven't heard any talk about that, even though it's like the summer isn't even summer is barely started. Like,
yeah. And
you know,
and that AC situation is the next part of my pulpit, you know. But the first thing that I'll say is like, I'll even get behind Trump on this. If raking the forest is going to help, let's get some rakes. If that's actually going to help, let's get out there and rake that thing. You know, anything that we've come up with that we even slightly agree on to not have to live on this hellish sunscape, let's do that.
Yeah, just no people. All I've heard is people being like, yeah, climate change sucks. And I haven't heard any like, obviously we need to address climate change. And in the long run, do you know, anything other than that is slapping a Band-Aid on the sucking chest wound. Yeah. But still,
sometimes putting a Band-Aid on the
wound. I'd rather have
a
Band-Aid. Yeah,
sometimes putting the Band-Aid on the wound allows you to live a little bit longer in order to get real help, you know?
Exactly, yeah. So
put pressure on that. Somehow put pressure on that.
Like 700 people died. Like,
well, that's the other
it's
part.
It's crazy.
Is that social media, the world over, is totally just like, all, oh, these wussies and blah, oh, they died from this, that. People are just terrible, absolutely terrible. Just,
just
attitudes of women deserve to be abused if they stay with their abuser, and just all sorts of terrible ideas are coming from people. And I research a lot of them, and I'd like to think that they're all Russian bots, but they're not. I went to high school with some of them, so.
Yeah, no, I saw people was like, oh, well, it gets that hot in Arizona. It's like, freaking, you have air conditioning in every building in Arizona.
Right. And
you know
what to do, you know?
Yeah.
You Arizonans, the rest of us make fun of you when it rains, you know?
Yeah,
because
exactly.
Down in Arizona, if it rains for a week in a row, they got like skulls and crossbones on TV because the soil has no drainage. And so when they get that amount of rain, you know, people's homes are straight up flooded from like multiple days worth of rain. And the rest of the country is making fun of you, Arizona, because I used to live there.
Yeah.
You know what it is.
Guarantee, take any of my high school friends from Reading who were, you know, talking about this stuff. And if they had been in my apartment last weekend, they would have thought it was too hot. Hmm. You know?
Oh, yeah. Oh.
Which, you know, I'm from Reading. I get it. We have hot temperatures, but you know what? We don't go outside. We're not in those hot temperatures.
I think a big part of the problem is people again, we talked about this last week about how people all feel like the world was just like me, everything would be okay. And, you know, transgender and gay and bathrooms make me think of this a lot. You know, and I had this conversation with my mother-in-law.
Jump.
And we're talking about people who are gay.
Uh-huh. And always a fun thing to do with your mother-in-law.
Yeah, totally. Well, I forget how we get there, but I end up asking her, because she's all right. I mean, she has.
Okay.
She's even, she doesn't care. But I say, because we're talking about understanding other people's problems. And I say, well, what about gay people? Is it okay to be gay? And she says, well, yeah, it's okay to be gay. And I say, so you understand it. You know what it's like to want to have sex with a woman and spend your life with another woman. And she's like, what? No, I don't understand that at all. And I'm all, but it's okay. And she says, yeah, I'm all, apply that to everything. Literally yeah. Everything. You don't need to understand it to be okay with it. You know, it's like, there's a lot of crap in this world that I don't understand, but I do understand that if 80 people died in Vancouver, I feel bad and something should be done about it.
Yeah, I don't know. People are by and large just so ignorant.
Are
and
they?
So just, I so confident in their ignorance, I think, on things.
Well, I think a big part of it is a refusal to change. You know, yeah. Like my favorite is like, dudes who are just, oh yeah, she's not the woman I married 30 years ago. And I'm all, thank God, that'd be freaking weird, man. That's yeah. Like the number one red flag. If Terry hadn't changed in the last 5 years, I'd be all, we need to go to counseling. Something's stagnant here.
In the last year, Fort Hood in Texas has seen 39 dead and missing persons, including suicides and murders. 11 of these are still unexplained. I don't know much else to say about this other than that many military bases in the U.S. saw soldiers who are ostensibly far from any fighting die under mysterious circumstances. Possible explanations for this include cartel or gang violence, although this could only explain a fraction of the incidents. This was a bizarre article.
It gets my mind reeling on all sorts yeah. of great science fiction and horror that this thing could be. Unfortunately, it's probably just weird rapist dudes, but you know, I'd like yeah. to think that it's some sort of crazy haunting from traumas of the past.
So the article I read suggested, and it was this long Vanity Fair article, and it really, like, it was the sort of article, like in the Lantern article, where it, you know, has a bunch of poignant moments and doesn't really have any answers, right? And it suggested a number of things.
You're going to get to real news reporting at this
point. Exactly. So, like, one of the victims, for instance, was, like, killed by her boyfriend. And, like, the military was, like, super reluctant to investigate and all this stuff. And so, yeah, I think that's part of it. And some of the other part of it is, like, a lot of the people in this who were assigned to this particular place, like, were very low-income people who had, like, some gang affiliation, so that makes sense. I did like, however, that in the article, it just as a passing reference pointed out that the town is in fact built on an ancient Indian burial ground.
Everything is built on an ancient Indian burial ground in the US.
Well, yeah, not everything, just like every other thing.
Right, yeah. Well, I'm glad you brought up the income thing, because that's what was passing through my head, and I was kind of figuring out a way to, you know, put it out there without offending anybody. But
yeah,
we do, you know that people from lower incomes and harder hardships in lives tend to not tend to, but are statistically more likely to have some of these problems. And a lot yeah. of people who join the military are that people just starting out in their lives, or people trying to escape from their lives, or people, you know, just wanting to get away from where they currently are at and reset.
Yeah, it did point out that, like, some of these problems happen, you know, all over, essentially, in every base. And 2020, also, like, this was last year, and it's the same sort of thing. Like, we're hearing in the news about, like, this crime wave. It's like, there was an unprecedented economic recession suddenly. Like, right. Of course there was a crime wave, you know, if it continues, like, this year or next year, then like wake me up, right? But so I think a lot of this is, you know, you pack a lot of like low income, low education, young people, mostly young men, into a place. And because Fort Hood, as I understand it, this might not be right, but it's not like, it's not where they do a lot of like the high end intelligence work and stuff. So it's
infantry,
it's
stuff like that.
Right. So it's
where you're gonna,
so the demographics just are such a way that, you know, violent death, suicide, whatever is more common. It's just so weird. 11 soldiers die and their deaths are unexplained. How?
It's like the UFO.
How does that happen?
Right. Like the UFO thing. You think the military would be all over this.
Yeah.
You think the military would be on, no, lights out at this. Everybody's going these places. We're putting trackers on you. We own you. We're going to die.
Right.
So it's weird. And
if they were dying in Afghanistan, like, oh, okay, you know, stuff happens, I guess. But they're in Texas, you know?
Right.
We should be able to get a handle on this.
And ultimately, it's just terrifying. It's yet another thing that's sort of saying that the military isn't on top of their business. And frankly, I find that terrifying, you know?
And I don't know. I want to point out, I've never been in the military. I'm sure there's any number of people who are listening to this and rolling their eyes.
Like, well, they might be rolling their eyes, but I would bet you a lot of the people who are rolling their eyes are not in the military. And here's I want to shove in their faces. I think the military guys are probably sitting there going like, what the hell is up with these commanders? They should have their stuff done. Don't walk on your boss's lawn. You know, real military guys.
Mm-hmm.
But the people who are coming down on this basically saying that it's just them and, oh, whatever, money shouldn't allow you to make bad decisions. That's a lot of these stoic guys who have this deal like, well, I take care of my own and they should do theirs too. And like, it's a statistic that I brought up before, but I always think it's interesting. And that is that after World War I, Germany was so decimated that it's estimated that 1 in 3 women performed some sort of prostitution to take care of their families. And it just shows that what economic collapse and stuff can do to force people into doing things that we all say that we would never do. You know, everybody says, oh, well, I would never do that. Well, I'm a big, tough guy. I got kids. If I had to prostitute myself to feed my children, I would do that. So it's like, you know, people need to, I don't know, people just need to put themselves in check and shut the hell up.
I mean, I think the
obviously very frustrated here lately.
I think the pandemic and the economic issues are like a sort of second order cause, right? Because these people are, like, they didn't lose their jobs, right? You know, they're all still getting paid, even if they're getting paid to stay home and quarantine, you know. But I think it's just this generally contributes to an environment that probably, like, ripples through their social circles and, you know, intensifies some of these issues.
Well, I gotta say, there better be a great horror movie in the works out there about what the real cause of this is.
Maybe give it a couple years.
Too soon?
Yeah, maybe. We'll talk about this in 2030.
All right.
And in a new survey last week conducted by the Pew Research Center, 51% of Americans believe that UFO sightings cataloged in the UFO report from June were visits from intelligent extraterrestrials. Interestingly, in the same report, 87% rejected the notion that these extraterrestrials represented a threat to national security.
51% believe in alien visits from the because of these,
right?
The Navy footage,
or specifically, they believe that these pieces of footage are alien visits. You know, who knows whether they already believed or what? But
because I mean, I'm sitting here on an alien show, and I'm not even. Right.
Yeah, I'm like, whoa, there. That seems a little like, yeah. And I'm the paranormal person, so it's like,
you're a paranormal person.
It's yeah. I mean, I radiate an aura of menace,
right?
But the point is it's kind of crazy to me that a little over half of Americans are like so sure of this now.
But climate change is fake.
Right. Yeah. Like, I don't know. I don't know if it's the same people or just, and sometimes polls are off. I'm sure there's a margin of error, but even if it's 45%, that's still right. Like, you, alien, it's still a long shot, guys. Okay. But this is aliens. But I think part of it is that the news reporting on this has, I can see how it would lead you to that impression.
Right. And to pull myself back from my hoity-toity hipsterness, you know, I just said, oh, and global warming's not real. The flip side of this is it could just show exactly how much Americans feel taken advantage of by authority and that they just have no faith in it anymore. And that it's the Wild West of deciding what's real and what isn't.
I think that's what it is. Yeah. And I think that it epistemologically sucks because the people who are always like, oh, don't listen to experts, make up your own mind, look at the evidence. It's like, yeah, but the thing about that is that you, my friend, are dumb. You know, you are not ready to do this. This is why we have people who specialize in topics to, but you know, I can't say that it isn't on some level rational to reject institutions given everything.
Right. And also at the same time, I would say that the scientific community historically has been a little too quick to dismiss anything possibly alien, because the answer is always,
oh, okay, I see maybe. What you mean. Yeah.
The answer is always maybe. I mean, you can't disprove a negative. You can't prove, you know, it's like, that's just not the way this works.
Well, I mean, that I think that's exactly why they dismiss it, because it's, you need to bring them any kind of evidence before they'll consider anything.
Well, I think that's where the clash happens between the scientific community and the rest of society, is that, well, I brought this up before, the novel coronavirus, using the word novel, I think was a huge mistake, because I think it was a scientific word used in the context of scientific thought that the rest of us didn't put together the gravity of what that meant. You know, I think we just need better translators from science.
Absolutely. Yeah. I lay the blame for a lot of this on just our media, which just, you know, science writers usually don't have a science background. So they're just like trying and oftentimes failing to parse what the scientists are telling them, which is fair. Like that's always the way it's going to be. Right. But there's also a huge element of sensationalism, I think. With, because you don't want a Science Weekly magazine, 50 articles that say scientists discover new boring thing, probably not real. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, and that's what it would be if they didn't sensationalize, which I think they shouldn't. I think this is a symptom of the fact that basically all of our media is just corporate run for-profit shilling, designed to appeal to just attention span destroyed guinea pigs.
All right, coming up next, we have Nomar Slevic sharing a very intense
story. Who we do like.
Who was abducted multiple times throughout his life, talking about Nomar's new book, Granite Skies, A Disconcerted Journey Through the Unknown. Go ahead and unpack that title. All right, welcome back to Radio Wasteland, and our guest tonight is Nomar Slevic. I just covered how to pronounce his one, and I found myself like looking over here anyway. because I don't trust it, you know.
You did great. You did great.
And your book that we're going to be discussing is Granite Skies, A Disconcerted Journey Through the Unknown.
That's the one, yeah.
Which, you know, I like a descriptive title. That's a very descriptive title.
Thank you.
Yeah, what the hell does that mean? That means nothing. You know, that's like the title itself is the mystery.
It's like walking through a Walmart at 2 a.m.
Yeah, kind of, because disconcerted is, you know, it's confusing and it's scary and it's overwhelming. And into the unknown, you know, implies, at least in my opinion, you know, something otherworldly. And when you have the Granite Skies title above that, I'm also hoping that it implies that maybe the something otherworldly might involve extraterrestrials. And we pondered many different titles, even like Earthling and, you know, a bunch of different things, but we set it on Granite Skies and I came up with the subtitle, and we were happy about it because it is, Mike's story is confusing and scary and sad and amazing and all those things. So,
yeah, well, you know, for full disclosure, I am like 50% beard and 50% snark, so I can't help but to, but I do have to admit that, you know, when I read what this is about and started reading the book, I'm just like, holy smokes, this, even purely on an entertainment level, which, you know, sometimes it gets a little rough when you're dealing with somebody's traumatic life and you're all, oh, that was
yeah.
entertaining, you know?
Yeah.
It is mixing kind of multiple things that we all find interesting in this circle. And that's like missing people in the woods and we got extraterrestrials, you know? And so why don't you just tell us first how you got interested in this? Cause it didn't happen to you. Sure. You wrote the book about somebody else. How'd you get connected?
Yeah, that's true. I guess it actually goes back to like 83 or 84 when I had my own, I guess, UFO experience. And then since then, I've had 11 other sightings. And I don't even consider myself an experiencer. And Mike and I argue about this, but because I've only just seen, you know, lights or objects in the skies, I don't believe anything else in regards to extraterrestrials more traumatic has happened to me. And so I've just seen some things. But, you know, this first sighting in 83, 84, I was sound asleep in my bed. I was like 4 years old, 5 years old. And a loud bang woke me up. And I was trying to figure out, you know, the cause for that bang. And after a moment, I started hearing little pattering, you know, little noises on the window. And I was like, oh, it's rain. That must be a thunder and lightning storm. So I kind of kneeled up on the bed. And I'm looking out the window and sure enough, it's raining. And I see lightning every once in a while. And I'm hearing the booms of thunder. But then after a moment, there was this really disturbing, I can only describe it as a lightning bolt that got stuck in a cloud. That's still how my mind remembers it. And again, I was only 4 or so years old when I saw it. But if I were to ask you to draw a lightning bolt, you would draw like this jagged yellow line, or kind of looks like the charging indicator on your smartphone or something. and that's what I saw stuck in a cloud. And there was electricity coming off of it. And there were booms associated with it. And then I don't really know what happened after that. I must have fallen back asleep. I wake up the next morning. I go to the bathroom. When I'm walking from the bathroom back to my bedroom, I can see out my bedroom window and that lightning bolt is still there. So and even at such a young age, I go, I know that's not normal. I got to go show my dad. So I ran downstairs, grabbed my dad, brought him upstairs. And I was trying to explain to him what I was seeing, but it was gone. And I must have been carrying on quite a bit because, you know, he was at first doing that thing that adults do with their kids. They kind of, you know, pat him on the head and be like, yeah. You know, just trying to get me to calm down. But he finally had to like get down on the level.
Polite way of saying shut up and go back to bed.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm a parent. But I'm familiar with the
with the technique.
There you go. Yeah. And typically effective. But at this point, I must have been carrying on because I remember him getting down on my level. He puts his hands on my shoulders and he's like, listen, and this isn't verbatim, but it was something to the effect of, you know, listen, it didn't even rain last night. And that was my big takeaway. Mm-hmm. That's like, besides the seeing the lightning bolt and electricity coming off of it, it was those words, it didn't even rain last night. So that just kind of
spooky.
Yeah, yeah. And yeah, that's when I actually started getting scared because I was more fascinated before. That's when I got scared.
The lack of rain, I mean, I can't help but to think about this. So, you know, you're thinking that you saw rain and of course we have to consider that you're young, you know, you're a
sure
possibly unreliable narrator at this.
Absolutely.
But, you know, the rain, I mean, if it's not raining, this is an aspect to the story I don't think I've ever, to a story, a alien sure experience that I've never heard before. I mean, maybe yeah, you flew out of the water. Or, I don't know.
Maybe because I lived right across the street from the St. John River. I was actually neighbors with Canada. I could actually, like, now at my age, I could, like, throw a rock if I was standing at my old house, throw a rock and hit Canada. That's how close it was. Uh-huh. And between us and Canada was the St. John River. So that is certainly a possibility. Also, I've wrestled with maybe it was a screen memory and maybe more did happen, but I just have further inkling of what it could be. Now, 2 weeks after that, my folks woke me and my sister up in the middle of the night. It could have been 3 a.m. It could have been 10 at night. I'm not really sure, but when you're young, you know, it felt like it was the middle of the night. And they were getting us all dressed up in our winter gear. And then they brought us outside to show us that the Northern Lights was happening. It's the only time I've ever seen it. I can remember it like it was yesterday. I can remember it just like I'm remembering that lightning bolt stuck in the cloud. And I think what happened was at such a young age, these two, in my opinion, otherworldly events happening in the sky must have instilled in me like weird stuff happens up there. So I just got to keep looking. And that was kind of like a catalyst of constantly looking up. And that kept snowballing into my teens and then into my 20s. And during that time, I was trying to devour all the paranormal and UFO books that I could. And having my own little personal collection, I was looking through it one day. And I said to myself, hey, there's no book here about UFOs specifically in my home state. There's books about UFOs in California and, you know, in all these different places or specific stories of specific individuals out of Florida or whatever. And I said, I'm going to write that book about UFOs in Maine. And that kind of started me on my quest, which I think turned into a 6 or 7 year quest because I had no idea what I was doing, how to write a book. But that ended up being my first book that I ever published called UFOs Over Maine. I've since put out a few other books, this latest one being Granite Skies. And through the course of, you know, making connections as an author does, being on podcasts and, you know, giving lectures and things like that, that's where I met Mike Stevens. And I started hearing bits and pieces of his encounter from other people, not even from Mike. Mike is very reserved. You know, if he doesn't know you, he's very cordial, but he just doesn't come out and get in your face and be like, here's what happened to me. It's all very internal. And I also started hearing about other things he was doing.
I have to admit that stoicism adds to the credibility. You know, if somebody's screaming in my face about what happened to him, I'm just like, whatever, man, here's a dollar, leave me alone.
Yeah. It's like, and I've had to walk away from some people like that, you know, when I was interested in telling their story or something. But sometimes it gets to be too much. And with Mike, I kind of kept getting drawn in and I'd hear a little tidbit. Then I'd ask Mike about it. He'd explain that tidbit or expand on it, but then shut down again. As we got closer, I mean, we're not even the best of friends. Like after writing this book, and I'm not saying like we fight or argue, we're just, you know, we live hours apart, you know, so it's not like we hang out all the time, but I love the guy. And after writing this book with him, because it goes into some really dark stuff, it almost feels like he's a buddy from war, you know, where we're in the foxholes together or something. And there's like this bond that we created. Like he suffers from some mental health issues that in his opinion, and in my opinion, the extraterrestrial stuff was a catalyst of, and I have my own issues, health, mental health issues that I struggle with. Extraterrestrials were not the catalyst, but all young of the trauma, symptoms. And,
you know, I mean, regardless of where it comes from, I mean, we know young trauma. You know, family life causes that. I mean, why would
absolutely
it abducted?
Yeah, absolutely.
By not your neighbor.
Yeah.
Your neighbor abducts you. You have trauma.
Yeah. Your neighboring galaxy, perhaps.
Right. Totally.
Yeah. So I guess that was a long-winded way to say how I met Mike.
That's all right. Yeah. Long-winded is what we do here. You are listening to No More Slim. You are listening to No More. So did you go to him and basically say, listen, man, I want to make the book all about you now that I'm in? Or did he say,
I don't think either of those, actually, but also a mixture of those. So I'm always in the throes of like two or three different projects, like I am right now. When I was thinking about writing Mike's book, I was then. So what ended up happening was, I think about 3 years ago now, Mike and I had this really long phone call. We were just, I think I was going down to an area where he puts on events. I was going to go down there in the following couple of weeks to give a presentation. And we had a phone call where we were connecting about that and, you know, just discussing like some business aspects of it, you know, what I might need, blah, blah, blah. And then we just got to personal conversation. And I was like, so tell me about, you know, blah, blah, blah again. And he's like, you know what? Well, let me tell you this too. And he started opening up. We were moving beyond acquaintances, and he really started to open up. And the next thing you know, it was like 2 hours later, and he basically told me everything. And it was a lot. So we get off the phone, whatever. And it was probably, you know, once I got down there, I was talking to him again about everything he told me. And I was thinking it would make a really great documentary, make a really great book. It would make something really great. Maybe, you know, just do a podcast with him or something. But his story is so involved. I didn't think a documentary could cover it properly. There's not a lot of, you know, fancy images to show. It's really just a story.
It's like, how do you do a documentary off of somebody's life where they have no... It's like, do you just show a bunch of pictures of them as a kid? You know, how does that translate to a documentary?
I'm sure there's a way to do it. And I'm still kind of playing around with that idea. I bring it up to Mike every once in a while. Mm-hmm. I think that'll be a long-term thing that I just kind of keep stewing over. Anyways, I finally kind of settled on, I really think his story needs to be told. And I shared that thought with him, and he was almost immediately on board, but he had some concerns and questions, you know, because the book goes into some dark places, and not everybody he was close to, immediate family included, knew everything about his story. And if I'm going to do basically an extraterrestrial biography on this man, I want to share everything, you know. I don't want to do a watered down version, or you can say this, but maybe not that. And I just, whatever I work on and put out, I want it to be as honest and genuine as possible, and as non-biased as possible as well, which is really tough in this field.
You want the full story.
Yeah. And I expressed that to him, and you know, that was something he had to think about. And he finally came to this conclusion, you know, I think it was just a few weeks, that he was on board to do it. And so that started the heavy lifting of, we had to meet in person, in my opinion, anyways, that's what I like to do, and have a long form interview. So we ended up conducting two long form interviews where I went down to Southern Maine, then I went down to New Hampshire, and he met with me and he told me everything. I asked a bunch of questions. We met again. I had him tell me everything again, and I asked him a whole bunch of other questions. And it was really, I kind of keep harping on this, but it was heavy stuff, and we had to take breaks. There was laughing, there was crying. It was really heavy, and it was a lot of stuff to get through. And even during some of the interviews, I would get lost in his story, almost like it was a movie developing in my mind or something, and I would get kind of lost into this abduction scenario that he's talking about. And all of a sudden I was like transformed and I'm there. And so now I'm not taking notes on my laptop. Like, thank goodness I had an audio recorder going, and I'm just getting lost in this story. And then, you know, his abduction scenario ends and I'm kind of brought out of it and I'm feeling lightheaded. I, you know, my eyes are teared up a little bit. I'm like, Jesus, that's intense what you just told me.
Is that something that happens with every project? Is that like just part of the way that you get into the zone, or is that like this story was just so crazy that it affected you in ways you didn't anticipate?
I would say it's more of the latter, but the first part is true too. Especially if I can be with a witness in person and we're talking through some of my other books, not everybody wants to meet in person. Somebody, sure. You know, some people just want to text and not even do a phone call. And so those are a little bit tougher, and I'm just trying to, you know, get as much detail as possible. But when I can meet with a witness, that's where it gets really emotional for me. And again, I'm trying to be honest. I'm trying to ask interviewer questions, but I kind of get caught up in it a little bit too, and which is probably not always the best thing, but I'm human and, you know, so like it's all good to me, but
well, you end up kind of stewing in it afterwards, don't you? I was watching Jimmy Fallon, and Questlove, who's on there, was the guest, and he's got a new movie coming out called The Summer of Soul, which is like a documentary of a like R&B version of Woodstock that went on at the time. And he said that he never made a movie before, and he's got 40 hours worth of footage. And the way that he worked on it was he played it on a loop around his house for 5 months as he made notes about the parts that he wanted in the movie in order to edit down. And I'm just all, and then I'm hearing this from you, and I'm imagining these long form interviews. And then you probably sat there. He got to get it off his chest and walk away. Don't get me wrong. He had the experience. And in the
first
he gets a break. But, you know, and then here you go home with hours upon hours of audio to listen to over and over again.
Absolutely. We had two long form interviews. I think it was a total of 6 or 8 hours that I had on audio, and I must have listened to it. It feels like 100 times, you know, probably more. And then some of it I actually transcribed, because some of the transcription needed to happen for some pieces that I wanted in the book. And, you know, and all the quotes are taken directly from his mouth. It's not like it was written down somewhere and I could just copy and paste it or something. So there was lots of transcribing for him to tell his story, and I'm just kind of narrating around it. But the book took on this life of its own, which I have not experienced in the other works, to kind of go back to what Kara was saying before. Yeah. It took on this life of its own where, you know, the underlying theme is Mike's extraterrestrial encounters. I think Mike likes to say a lot, we've done a lot of podcasts together, and he likes to say a lot that the extraterrestrials get you into the book, and then the story about people keeps the pages turning. And it turned into this really, I don't know, earnest book about people and mental health. And none of us know what we're doing. We're just trying to survive. And it was, you know, this again, there was this underlying theme of extraterrestrials. Then there's Mike's story. And then my story started to unfold as like this third layer. And it's not always in your face. It's just kind of trickled in here or there, but I don't shy away, because Mike was so raw and genuine and honest in what he shared with me. It just felt natural and instinctual to share my own rawness. You know, so there's stuff about me in the book that I typically don't talk about. And it was actually tough for like my folks to read, you know, and some stuff they didn't know, you know, like reading the book, they found out that I had been to a therapist and they didn't know that before. And Mike's father finally read the book. I think Mike sent me a message. God, it might've been just 2 weeks ago now. His dad finally read the book and had no idea some of the trauma and some of the dark places his mind had gone, and told him he was really proud of him for sharing that story.
That's good. Yeah.
His dad was a believer beforehand, but I don't think he knew the extent of Mike's
issue. What I was asking. His dad became a believer over the years, not because of the book.
Yes, but because yes.
Right. Yeah, that's
what I was right. Saying. Right.
You are listening to No More Slumming.
You are listening to No More. Okay, well, I think we probably left people hanging long enough. You know, like, let's summarize this. Of course, they're going to have to read the book, but can you walk us through this story of what happened?
Yeah. I mean, there's, I think, all told, there might be like 39 encounters that we go through in the book.
Holy smokes.
Whoa. Yeah, and that's... Oof. That's like the more of the major ones. Like, he has something weird happen, you know, almost weekly, you know, and he likes to share a lot of that with me, like even in the moment when they're happening. But to chronologically tell a story with a narrative, and in my opinion, I write how I talk, and I also want to write almost like a novelization of what's happening. It's just so it's interesting to get through. I know growing up and, you know, consuming all these UFO books, they read like textbooks and there were a lot of them were slogs to get through, you know. Maybe Jerome Clark is an exception, or, you know, there's a few out there that are exceptions.
9 times out of 10, I don't do nonfiction for that.
It's tough to get through.
They say the best nonfiction reads like fiction, and the best fiction reads like nonfiction, is a quote I've heard on that. So I think it's true.
Yeah, you know, and I'm a proponent of that. So, you know, I strive to do that. I don't know if I'm always successful, but anyways, to start off Mike's story, his story actually starts at like 3 or 4 years old as well. And he was at his grandmother's house. This all takes place in New Hampshire. He was at his grandmother's house at some sort of function. He doesn't remember what the function was about. And he remembers somehow he got outside, which that even seems odd to him, because with a house full of adults, how he got outside without anybody noticing, because his grandmother's house is so close to the road. It was kind of a thing for when the kids went outside, you know, adults had to be there so they wouldn't run out to the street. So he's wondering how he got outside. Now, this first encounter actually happened with his little cousin. So his cousin, I believe, was just maybe 2 years old at the time. Mike is like 3 or 4 years old. And he remembers being compelled to go outside. He finds himself outside. He's with his cousin. And he sees this, for lack of a better term, a silver disc rise from this thicket of trees that's probably a quarter mile behind his grandmother's house. It rises up, and now it's above the treetops, and it floats fairly slowly towards them, and it stops over this telephone pole that's basically in his grandmother's driveway. And he recalls that they're both standing there just staring up at it, and then he describes what's like a bad B-movie edit, where a second later they're standing in a different portion of the driveway and the UFO is now hovering over a slightly different spot in the sky. And it all happened like in a second. And he was just like, whoa, what just happened? Like there was a skip in time or something. And then he said after that
time, or did Ed Wood direct this?
Right, exactly. And he said, after a moment, the UFO just shot straight up and out of sight. He recalls the whole thing only lasting for a few seconds, doesn't remember a whole lot about after that. So it wasn't until his 20s when he had his one and only hypnotic regression session. And he was actually part of a paranormal team who was doing an investigation, and the place that they were investigating, the owner of that place actually did hypnotic regression. And as like a trading of services, this hypnotic regression person offered each team member a session for, you know, multiple investigations of his place. And when it was Mike's turn, the hypnotic regression person decided that, or told him in this odd way that we need, there's something that happened when you were young and that's what we need to talk about, you know? And it was like a bit of an unspoken thing. And Mike was like, oh, okay. And Mike wasn't really thinking it was about the UFO, but maybe thought it was. He wasn't sure if this person was psychic or what was really going on there. So they have this hypnotic regression session. And I've heard the tape. It's fascinating and sad. I actually include part of it in a podcast I did last year. And I actually transcribe almost the full thing in the book. But during this hypnotic regression, Mike recalls seeing the UFO at a much lower level than the telephone pole. It's probably 35 feet around, something like that, maybe 20 feet high. There's a window. He said that there was light emanating from this window that kind of seemed like the dome light in a car, you know, like a soft yellow. He could see humanoid silhouettes, but no real detail. He then recalls that there was some sort of conveyor belt sort of thing, and kind of remembers being on it, kind of not. And then all of a sudden he's laying down in this area. His mind knows that he's on the craft. He doesn't really recall entering the craft, but he's just in it now. And he doesn't even know if he's laying on a table or if he's floating on his back, you know, just in midair. He just knows he's very comfortable. And he can feel the presence of three things at his shoulders and his head, you know, standing around him. And he said there's also some sort of commotion going on down by his feet. And he also thinks his cousin might be down towards his feet, maybe laying on another table or floating in the air down there. And maybe the commotion by his feet is concentrated on his cousin, but he's not sure. He described them as really like tall gray aliens, although he described their skin as like olive, greenish, brownish sort of color. He said that the skin was fairly coarse, and he doesn't remember any sort of examination other than he remembers thinking at that time that this was like their version of a doctor's appointment, and it was just like a common checkup, and it was no big deal, and then it was over, and they were put back. And that's really the extent of his encounter inside the craft. And again, he didn't know any of that or remember any of that till he was in his 20s.
Yeah, through now, the regression. When he came out of the regression, did he now cognitively remember this? I'm not really sure how that works. Like,
yeah, I'm not sure how that works either. And Mike would be honest and say, you know what? I don't know. I don't know if it's just listening back and I remember, but
sure.
But yeah, he that memory is now in his head. How it got there, I'm not 100%. Yeah. Now, what happened the following years since that first encounter, while he's still young, he ended up having this 9-month-long series of visits to his home. And he described it as almost like school lessons. He kind of remembers the beginnings and the ends of them and doesn't really remember a whole much about the middle of it. But during a 9-month period, almost weekly, he was visited by what he called like these smoke aliens. They kind of looked wispy and sort of humanoid. But inside of them, it was just all shadowy and wispy and could never visually see them perfectly. But his consciousness knew that they were, you know, four different figures. It's really hard to explain, you know, what he saw, but you know, that's what he told me that he experienced. And he said that there were two males, and the two males, in his opinion, seemed military of some sort. And they were really by the book. They were all about, you know, him making sure that he gets his lesson plans done. They were very concerned about time. You know, like this starts then and then it ends then and now we got to go. He also describes one of the entities as a young boy, right around his age. And then he described another one as like as female and sort of a teacher slash motherly person. And that was the one giving the lessons. He recalls one time that the boy the child entity was sitting on the floor. Mike asked if he could sit next to the boy, and he was granted permission. Everything was happening telepathically, he said. He was sitting next to the boy, and he looked over at the child entity and asked in his head, "What are you?" And he said the child entity put this image in his mind of Rosie the robot from the Jetsons. And he took that comedically, and he said they shared like a humorous moment together. And I thought that was kind of sweet, actually.